From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Images of the heads of state of the two Koreas meeting over the weekend at a historic summit were cause for celebration. South Korea's Moon Jae-in and North Korea's Kim Jong-un stepped toward one another across from the official border in the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, where the summit was held. The two smiled warmly for cameras as they held hands and walked, offering the perfect photo opportunity for peace in the region. At stake is North Korea's intention to denuclearize and South Korea's military dependence on the U.S. for protection. The summit has now paved the way for a historic meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, which Trump tweeted could take place in the same location as the weekend summit. Meanwhile, Moon Jae-in has gone as far as suggesting Trump be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for bringing the two Koreas together, even though it was Moon himself who was credited for the diplomatic work that led to this moment. Last week, ahead of the summit, we spoke with Christine Ahn, founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Christine now returns to our airwaves for a follow-up conversation. Welcome back.
Thanks, Sonali.
So what did you make of what happened over the weekend? I feel like it was far more symbolic than substantive.
Well, I would say it was both, absolutely. I mean, for the leaders of North and South Korea to meet at Panmunjom, which was the site where the armistice agreement was signed, which was the temporary ceasefire that halted fighting but did not formally end the war. And for, you know, Kim Jong-un to step foot into South Korean territory, and for him to invite Moon Jae-in to step foot into North Korean territory and to just show the kind of ease of crossing that demarcation line, I think was very powerful, and which was what we set out to do when we set out to cross the DMZ in 2015. But the declaration that they signed, the Panmunjom Declaration, is quite sweeping in many ways. And we have heard pundits and skeptics across the political spectrum basically say that this doesn't add anything new, especially in the context of the 2000 and 2007 joint declarations that North and South Korea signed. But I definitely view that very differently. I think that there are new statements, there's new framing, and clearly we are in a different context that makes this declaration and this summit ever so important.
What does the declaration actually state? And I mentioned the issue of denuclearization of North Korea, and Kim Jong-un has been, you know, he's sort of seemingly open to the idea, but was there anything about that put into the agreement?
Absolutely. I mean, so just from a broad perspective, the first major statement that the two Korean leaders outline in the joint declaration is, if I can just read, there will be no more war on the Korean Peninsula, and thus a new era of peace has begun. If you read past statements, they make such references as we will stop slandering the other side. And I mean, this they basically said in front of the world and to 80 million Koreans on the peninsula, the war has ended. I think that is a huge, significant statement. There are three components to this joint declaration. The first has to do with trying to overcome the division of the Korean people, really puts, you know, concrete steps. I mean, we know that just in the last 2 days, they have aligned the clocks. They were 30 minutes apart. Now they've aligned the clocks. And today, Moon Jae-in has already taken down the loudspeakers that were blaring propaganda across the DMZ. They said that they are going to set up a joint liaison office in Kaesong to facilitate communication. They've already committed to doing civil society engagement on June 15th, which was the anniversary of the 2000 declaration. They are going to do family reunions on August 15th. So that's one concrete piece. The next piece is reducing military tensions. And they have designated the West Sea, which has been the site of some pretty violent skirmishes between North and South Korea, as a maritime peace zone. They are going to transform the DMZ, where there's 1.2 million landmines, into a peace park. You know, these are pretty groundbreaking commitments. And then the last has to do with the denuclearization. And this is exactly what the declaration says. It says that the South and North Korea confirmed the common goal of realizing, through complete denuclearization, a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. And so I think that's a very concrete commitment. It sets both Koreas to commit to that. I think that we tend in the United States to put the onus squarely on North Korea, when in fact, if we look at the broader history, who introduced nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula? The U.S. The U.S. maintained covertly nuclear weapons in South Korea until George Bush Sr., and we regularly use nuclear weapons in testing and in the joint military exercises, we have them on submarines. I mean, the U.S. maintains a nuclear umbrella over South Korea. So when we talk about a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula, when we talk about denuclearization, I think we need to broaden the frame. And I think that's what the two Koreas set out to do when they made this commitment.
Is there any role that the recent nuclear test mountain collapse in North Korea might be playing in North Korea's seeming intention to denuclearize? There was an enormous mountain that literally, because of repeated nuclear testing, collapsed, jeopardizing to some extent North Korea's nuclear program.
Well, we know that it sent massive shocks, and obviously it poses tremendous health and environmental consequences. But I believe a South Korean official recently came out and said that while there were obviously was damage done to the mountain and to their capability, there are still aspects of it that are very much usable. And that has also been confirmed by 38 North, which regularly issues reports about North Korea's nuclear facilities and weapons program. So, you know, I think that is kind of a distraction from the real point, which is that this was a historic agreement. This is the beginning, I think, of a new era where you know, it's Korea for Korea. And another significant point of the declaration was about ending the Cold War division, because we have to recall, how was Korea even divided in the first place? It was the U.S., two State Department officials that literally tore a page from the National Geographic and drew a line across the 38th parallel. And that basically set in motion, this is the, you know, the 70th anniversary of the creation of two separate states. And so, you know, the United States has been in Korea, on the Korean Peninsula in South Korea since 1945. And I think this is an opportunity for the two Koreas to try to make an agenda, set the roadmap for a Korean Peninsula that advances Korean interests, not the interests of the U.S., not the interests of China. And I think that has been the reality, is that both nations have been very much caught in the growing tensions that have been escalating between the U.S. and China.
Now, Christine, what needs to happen within the two Koreas to make the Panmunjom agreement to ratify, to do, at least in South Korea, which is, you know, a democratically run country, does the do lawmakers there need to sign off on making this a reality?
Well, my understanding is that Moon Jae-in is hoping to introduce this to the National Assembly to be ratified. We obviously know that Kim Jong-un has the ultimate power, right, in North Korea. And, you know, I assume that South Korea overwhelmingly supports this. There was a survey that just came out the other day following the April 27th meeting, in which it showed that Moon Jae-in had 85% of South Koreans that viewed him favorably. So he has overwhelming support by the South Korean people. And let's not forget that it wasn't Trump who, I mean, maybe in an indirect way, because of the maximum pressure that threatened to totally destroy Korea, that brought the two Koreas together. But it really, I mean, I think the game-changing moment that allowed us to even be at this moment is the democratic rising of the people's movements that ushered in Moon Jae-in into power and really wanted a different kind of inter-Korean policy. And so 8 out of 10 South Koreans want there to be a peace agreement with North Korea. So I think the South Korean people are ready. Clearly, the North Koreans are ready. And so I think the real obstacle right now, the real challenge, the ball is in the U.S. court. And I think this is where progressives in this country, peace-loving people, we have to push our government to sign a peace treaty that ends the war. Because as much as North and South Korea want to advance this process, as long as the U.S. Still maintains its hostile policy against North Korea, I think denuclearization is going to be incredibly difficult.
Well, Moon Jae-in seems to think that Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize for fostering this. I'm wondering if Moon, Mr. Moon, is basically, you know, understanding the kind of person that Trump is, and hoping that that his fragile ego needs just this kind of massaging in order to push Trump to do the right thing?
I just, you know, he's so masterful and so gracious. And I think that was, you know, so evident on the world stage as the two leaders shook hands, as they embraced. You could just feel the genuine sentiment and the heartfelt desire of the two Korean leaders wanting to end 7 years of historic enmity. So I would say that, you know, the fact that Moon Jae-in said, you can take the Nobel Peace Prize, we will take peace.
Yeah, right.
Says so much about where they are coming from. And so we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility in this country, as a social movement in this country, to ensure that there is a formal closure by getting our government to sign the peace treaty.
And a previous South Korean leader did win the Nobel Prize for a similar sort of meeting, but that one that didn't result in what this summit seems likely to result in.
You know, it's a process. And Kim Dae-jung won the Nobel Peace Prize. Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un's father, should have won it with him, because it takes two to tango. But, you know, that's, you know, people tend to see these declarations as a just a window of time. And while the context is very much dictating the success, I mean, for example, Kim Dae-jung signed that towards the end of his term. I mean, he ended it in 2002, but also who was elected in 2000? But George W. Bush, and who was on the axis of evil, but North Korea. So I think that he faced tremendous challenges to advancing that joint June 16th, 15th agreement. And No Moo-hyun, who was the predecessor to Kim Dae-jung, signed the declaration in 2007. The difference is that Moon Jae-in is not even 1 year into his term. He has 4 more years to actually implement. And the kind of pace in which he has been moving is just breathtaking. And so I have tremendous hope that this will be the beginning of a new era, as they stated. And you know, the ability of the two sides to have moved so fast, and for Kim Jong-un to have been the first North Korean leader to be in South Korea, you know, on the other side of the military demarcation line, I think shows a real trust in South Korea. And that is the work of the previous administrations. Moon Jae-in was the chief of staff for No Moo-hyun, his, you know, the senior chief of staff, was, you know, in North Korea. I mean, you know, this is building on previous efforts between inter-Korean dialogue that was frozen for the last 10 years. And so their progress is because of trust that was established from previous administrations.
Right. This was the third time, I understand, that the leaders of the two Koreas met, but it was, of course, the first formal meeting at the DMZ of these two specific leaders. Now, let's talk about Trump and the U.S.'s role. Trump tweeted on Monday excitedly about the location of his meeting with Kim Jong-un. He wants to get in on the party. And he said, numerous countries are being considered for the meeting, with the word meeting in all caps, but would Peace House / Freedom House on the border of North and South Korea be a more representative, important, and lasting site than a third-party country? Just asking, exclamation point. Peace House is where the two Korean leaders met. What do you make of this tweet, Christine?
I think it's totally amusing, and it just shows very much how much Trump wants the same kind of pageantry and to be on the global stage. I understand that Mongolia, which is the other country that is being considered, doesn't quite have the media core or the Wi-Fi capability. But I think it would be actually quite symbolic, because again, back to the meaning of Panmunjom, which was where the armistice agreement was signed, which was where the leaders, military leaders of North Korea and the U.S. and the Chinese People Voluntary Army signed the armistice. And so I actually think it's quite fitting for Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un to meet at Panmunjom and to begin, hopefully, what will lead to the signing of a peace treaty to end the Korean War.
Now, what do you make of the fact that peace between the two Koreas may, of course, make less important the U.S.'s role in that region, that in some way the U.S. has, of course, benefited from the hostility between the two countries? There was a piece in the New York Times, and then there were other commentaries about how the two Koreas making peace with one another reduces the U.S.'s leverage in the region. There's talk of Trump's bargaining chip with North Korea slipping away. I was kind of appalled at these headlines suggesting that bargaining chips that rely on hostility, nuclear hostilities between two nations, is a good thing because it gives the U.S. more leverage. What do you make of it?
I think it just demonstrates the kind of U.S. exceptionalism that is so dominant in our media and among all the pundits. I mean, I believe there was a piece in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof that the U.S. Won't let go of South Korea. And so I recall when the Olympics were taking place and a delegation of the North Korean athletes traveled to South Korea, and Jonathan Chang of the Wall Street Journal tweeted, "Oh my gosh, get this, North Koreans in South Korea." And then somebody responded back, "Why is that so strange? And why is it so normalized that 30,000 U.S. troops still exist in Korea and nobody even thinks twice about that?" And that's because since 1945, the U.S. has had a military presence in South Korea on the Korean Peninsula. I think that the fact that South Korea is the 10th largest economy in the world and that they want to advance the interests of the Korean people. I mean, if we look at even just from a geopolitical perspective, South Korea has basically been an island. It's been disconnected from the rest of Asia in terms of the map because of the division of Korea. And North Korea has basically been also just tied to the border to China. I think that when you see a united Korea or a Korea that is no longer in a state of war, that is tremendously hopeful, not just for the millions of families that still remain divided, but for the tremendous opportunities to be connected to Asia and then to Europe. The railroads and the roads and just the reduction of the massive amounts of transportation required to import things into South Korea because it exists as an island. I think this, the two leaders see the benefits to them politically, economically, and militarily. They have also set out to begin the process of disarmament. And I think that's where we have to look at it from this broader frame I mean, we can tend to hear the disarmament experts who are so focused on the denuclearization of Korea. Well, I pose back to them, what about the militarization of Korea? What about the fact that a naval base was built on Jeju Island, a U.S. naval base with South Korea that's used to project power against China? What about the THAAD missile defense system that is being installed in Songju, south of Seoul, that is used to basically monitor and surveil China? And so for the Korean people that have been witnessing this massive militarization as a result of the ongoing Cold War that the U.S. has basically led and waged against Russia or China, Korea just doesn't want to play that role anymore. And I think it's hugely hopeful, not just for the 80 million Korean people, but I think it's hugely hopeful for the global community that wants world peace. I think Korea could be the beginning of a new era for world peace, and not just in terms of eliminating nuclear weapons from our world, but to really think about how we make peace. And the leaders doing that on the global stage last Friday, I think, was just a remarkable and breathtaking gesture that needs the international community's support at this critical moment.
Well, I appreciate your optimism, Christine. We'll certainly be following the story very closely. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
Christine Ahn is the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. We've been discussing the historic summit between the two Korean leaders late last week. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.